Except Justice Kroski will likely remain standing, given he's got some back issues that are better served by her remaining standing. So, State versus XS 21 AP 419. Could I please have your appearances?
Attorney Christopher Arnold.
All right. Good morning. The lineup is 25 minutes, followed by 30 with 5 minutes in rebuttal. Are you prepared?
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
Good morning, and may it please the court. So, first things first, my petition for review presents three issues. I would just note that based session in its response brief, it's my intention today to focus on the first two issues. Those two issues being, number one, whether the circuit court adequately explained why it was denying the state's waiver petition, and number two, whether the Court of Appeals properly applied this court's decision in State versus Klesser. I want to begin our conversation today by focusing on this first issue, the discretionary authority of the circuit court, because in many ways it is the most straightforward issue, and based on decades of settled precedent from this court, as well as the Court of Appeals, it's easily resolved in XS's favor. That precedent makes clear that a decision of the circuit court will be labeled as reasonable, and hence deferred to on appeal, if one, there is a rational explanation given. Two, the circuit court applies the correct law, and three, the circuit court bases its decision on facts in the record. So when we look at the record in this case, we look at the roughly 30 pages of explanation that Judge Grayson gave to the parties before rendering her ultimate decision. It's clear, it's abundantly clear, that that decision was proper and an appropriate exercise of the circuit court's discretion. And I think we can reach that decision by just taking a step back and looking at the decision the circuit court was being asked to make and what evidence to the circuit court in making that decision. This is a situation involving a child, and this child will remain in the juvenile justice system unless and until the state proves, following a waiver hearing, that there is clear and convincing evidence that he ought to be waived into the adult system and face adult consequences. So when asking the question, should I waive this juvenile, it's important to look at what evidence was presented to the circuit court to help it reach its decision. Well, the state called one witness. That witness was a social worker with the Division of Youth and Family Services. This is a person who was experienced with assessing the risk needs of juveniles. She was familiar with assessing the rehabilitative needs of juveniles. She was familiar with the tools in the juvenile justice toolbox. And she was ultimately more than capable of assessing whether the juvenile justice system could adequately respond to the situation in this case.
Counsel?
Yes.
It's not our job today, is it, to determine whether there was enough facts in the record to support waiver. In other words, we're not making a waiver determination. What we're asked to do is determine whether or not this trial court judge rendered a decision that's reasonably supported by the facts in the record and whether she explained her decision. And I think you might have mentioned in your brief, the appellate court is supposed to search the record. So I did that. I actually have a chart. I took each of the factors that the judge is supposed to consider in making the waiver determination, and then I put into my chart what the trial court judge actually said. And all I see from her is that the court summarized the evidence, but she absolutely stated all of the factors, but she never applied those factors to the facts that she had before her. Could you address that? Because that's how I have read it when I put in what her actual words were. In other words, she didn't make any findings for the most part.
So, number one, I would disagree to the extent that the court did not make any findings. I think if we look at the court's, again, 30-page explanation, we see the court at multiple points making a number of relevant observations how it was considering these statutorily required considerations. For example, the court, in discussing the seriousness of the offense, stated multiple times that it was agreed by all parties that this was a very serious offense. It stated that it was taking the seriousness of the offense seriously. The court also discussed, however, mitigating considerations in the memorandum filed by defense counsel. And so the court indicated that it was balancing those aspects with respect to that factor. The court also talked about the testimony from the social worker, the state's witness who was asking the court not to waive, talked about her assessment, as well as talked about the assessment of Dr. Thompson, who gave the court complimentary testimony indicating how excess could be treated, rehabilitated in such a way in the juvenile justice system while keeping the public safe. And the court ultimately made these remarks at the conclusion of its decision, where it was talking about its major focus was really balancing the nature of the offense, which again it had already found that this offense was serious, and it was talking also about the amount of time that was left in the system. And it's clear that what the court was most interested in was, can we deal with this situation in the juvenile system? And the court appropriately concluded yes and said, look, I've been given complimentary testimony by both witnesses. Both the state and the defense have called witnesses who have told me I should retain jurisdiction of this juvenile, that we can treat this juvenile and we can keep the public safe in doing so.
Counsel, you know, you're making a better analysis than I think the circuit court did here. If the circuit court had said that, I'm not sure that we would be here. But again, I'll walk through them with you. But the standard is under Galleon, with the exercise of discretion, merely stating what the required factors are is not properly exercised discretion. The court must make explicit findings related to the facts, relating the facts to the required criteria, and explain how those findings rationally support the decision being made. Here, the juvenile court did not do that. You just did it in your summary, but that's not what she said. I'll go through it. The statutory criteria, the personality of the juvenile. And here's a refrain that appears throughout the transcript. We talked about some of the personality traits. Whether the juvenile has a mental illness or developmental disability. Well, there is no support in the record for that. She said again, we talked about the juvenile's physical and mental maturity, but there were no findings about the juvenile's physical and mental maturity. The juvenile's pattern of living, prior treatment history, again, she summarized it, but she didn't make any findings. And quite frankly, counsel, as I go through it, every single thing she said would support waiver. We have a juvenile here who did not do very well when he was adjudicated delinquent the prior time. I mean, do you concede that he did not comply with the court's order? He did not take advantage of treatment. He didn't participate in running rebels. He didn't go to school. He was dealing drugs. And the judge recites all of this and then comes to the conclusion that I'm going to keep him in the juvenile system.
So I would make, I want to respond to everything that Your Honor just said. So I think the first thing I would say is, number one, when we look at what the statute requires, it says the court must consider these enumerated factors. And I would disagree. I think that the court did consider those factors. When we look, for example, at the first factor, just taking that as an example, the court indicated, look, I'm taking into account his family life, which there was evidence in the record about growing up in a home with domestic violence, about growing up with a severely mentally ill mother, said it was taking into account his relationship with Eric Garcia, his maturity level, said it was taking into account his post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis, which again was conceded by the state. So the court is picking out relevant pieces of the evidence that it believes is relevant to its consideration of each factor. Number two, I would disagree with the position I think taken by the state as to the granular level of review that this court is being asked to undertake. I think we need to keep in mind that this court exercises a deferential standard of review, and that standard of review requires the reviewing court to look for reasons to affirm. And Galleon, again, that's a landmark decision of this court, and it's a very important decision for sentencing. But even under Galleon, we are often willing to search the record. We do not require, quote unquote, magic words. If a court is speaking for 30 or 50 pages in sentencing a defendant, it might never say the magic words, protection of the public. But by applying our deferential standard of review, if we can look at the court's remarks and we can infer from those remarks how it is applying those factors, that will be upheld on appeal. Number three, with respect to Zander's specific history on supervision, there was testimony from the social worker. Again, the social worker was, I believe, the person who was responsible for supervising him and then ultimately authored the opinion saying we should retain him, indicated that there had been some compliance issues. I think it was, we could consider it a mixed record. There were some issues signing up for the program. Ultimately, Zander did sign up for the program. There was issues with schooling, but there was also some indication that maybe there were some issues going on with the school. So, and the court notes these things, makes note of them, is not ignoring them. But again, under our deferential standard of review, it's up to the circuit court how it wants to, what weight it wants to place on these things. And so certainly I think a different court, sure, could look at this record and say, look, I really want to place significant, emphasis on this, quote-unquote, bad behavior, and that's what I'm going to make the basis of my decision. Fine. Under our deferential standard of review, we recognize that in these situations, the discretionary situations, the situations we place circuit courts in dozens of times a day, where circuit courts are being asked to make exceedingly difficult judgment calls. They are on, I think, the front lines of our justice system, that we acknowledge in Martindale and in Harding. These are situations where reasonable judges can and do disagree.
They certainly can, but the judge has to explain her reasoning, another one of the factors. The crime was committed in a violent, aggressive, premeditated, or willful manner. She went on about whether it was premeditated or not, but said nothing about its violence, aggressiveness, or its willful manner. And since it hasn't been brought up, this is a teenager who unloaded a gun, shooting people at Mayfair Mall, injuring 8 people. Just in the middle of the day, started shooting up Mayfair Mall. And she doesn't address whether that's a violent, aggressive, or willful act.
Well, she says they see serious crime all the time.
So if I could respond to both of those comments, I think, number one, the court did look at the nature of the offense. And I went through this, especially in my reply brief. There's a very searching analysis based on this offense. And look, I am the state. There's no better way for me to describe what happened here than what the state has already provided. So concedes to a large extent, look, state, you're saying this is what happened. There's no dispute from the defense that this is serious. And in fact, the submission filed by defense counsel says this is gravely serious. But goes on to say, look, there are other elements of this offense which show me that this person does have a juvenile-like mindset. There's not a degree of planning. This is kind of improvisational. There's elements here which show a lack of maturity, etc. And the court chooses to focus on those. And so I don't think under GBK, which tells us the court merely has to state, you know, what factors it's considering. It's not, I don't think, required to go through every single subpart of the statute in reaching its decision. It has to indicate what it is relying on and why. And the court did that. And the court is, again, making a difficult judgment call here, certainly very serious. And again, as I stated previously, a different reasonable judge could look at this and say, based on this offense alone, I'm going to give all of my weight to that, and that's what I'm going to base my waiver decision on. That's not what the circuit court did here.
What did the circuit court say about public safety, about keeping the public safe? Because the record reflects that if this juvenile were retained in the juvenile justice system, first of all, kids aren't going to Lincoln Hills anymore. There's no facility right now because there's no funding for a facility in Milwaukee or, frankly, anywhere else in the state for a secure facility in the juvenile justice system for kids. So what did the judge say about that? All I found is we do have an ability to both keep the public safe and keep excess in a structured setting.
So
How is that applying the law, which the juvenile code is very clear that that is a primary consideration and a primary goal of the juvenile justice system is to keep the community safe. How did the judge explain how the juvenile justice system will keep the community safe when we had a kid who walked into Mayfair Mall and shot up the place in the middle of the day?
So I would say two things. Number one, it's not at all clear to me that we are not sending children to Lincoln Hills. It's my understanding that this issue is being litigated in circuit courts, whether in fact that remains a quote-unquote lawful placement under the statute due to the passage of law. This was discussed, I think, somewhat in the state's, in response to the state's mootness motion. I think that issue's ongoing. So I think that's number one. Number two, obviously the court has to think about the public interest. And I think we can define that in a number of different ways. I think the state focuses intensely on public interest must mean, need to incarcerate to keep public safe. I don't think that that's entirely accurate because I think even under the Juvenile Justice Code, there's a number of public interests. We acknowledge by creating a Juvenile Justice Code and treating children differently that part of the public interest is we can intervene and we can rehabilitate children at this sensitive age of their lives.
But even, my question is, what did this judge say on the record about how the juvenile justice system will be able to protect? Because all I can find is that conclusory statement that came after all the evidence that she summarized about how serious this offense was, undisputed, and how he didn't do well under supervision, under probation on his last offense, and how his family was trying to help him escape from the justice system, period. So, again, what is there in the record? What did the judge say about how the juvenile justice system could keep the community safe?
So, applying our standard of review, which requires us to look for reasons to affirm and to defer to the look at the totality of the record and the totality of the court's comments, we have the court indicating that it is placing a good deal of weight on the expert opinions of the social worker as well as Dr. Thompson, both of whom informed the court that excess's risk level could be reduced if he was treated in the juvenile justice system, that his criminogenic needs could be addressed in the juvenile justice system. And the court referenced that and talked about that in its decision. And I think inferred in that is a judgment that, look, what I've been told is if we retain this juvenile, we can ensure that we're responding to those things that make him dangerous, and we can make him less dangerous through treatment and rehabilitation in the juvenile justice system.
How much time was left in the juvenile justice system for this person?
At this stage, roughly, I believe, a year.
6 to 9 months, maybe? Wait, does she reference that, the time period that's left for and how that adequately protects the public and meets the needs of the juvenile?
So there was testimony from, again, both witnesses, and the court indicated that it had been given a diagnosis and a treatment plan and an outline under which the juvenile justice system could accomplish those goals. And the court indicated it was relying on that in reaching its decision.
How did the court reconcile that short period of time to meet the needs of this person who committed serious offense with the fact that in the past the person did not comply even with the most simple orders for treatment?
So again, I would submit that the decision of how the court wants to deal with Xander's prior record, that's the court's decision. That's up to the court as to how.
Yeah, I just want to see how she reconciled. Where is the record of how the factors are met with respect to the limited period of time left in the juvenile system, if not waived, to the adult system, and the fact that he failed miserably in the past when given very simple things to do within the juvenile system?
Well, again, I'm not going to accept the label failed miserably because I don't think that that is the label that the individual and the agency responsible for supervising access utilized. But again, the agency responsible for supervising Xander, Division of Youth and Family Services, in generating their waiver study, told the circuit court, we have enough time. We can handle this. We can do this. The circuit court relied on that. I don't know, respectfully, I do not know what else a circuit court is supposed to do when it is making an important decision and the state calls a witness who says, you should retain this juvenile, and the defense calls a witness who said, here's even more information about why you should retain this juvenile, and the court is supposed to make a decision whether there's clear and convincing evidence regarding retention.
Counsel, I presided at Children's Court for 2.5 years in Milwaukee, and I presided over a number of waiver hearings. I don't know that I ever had a social worker tell me that a kid should not be retained in the justice system. Here's what the judge is supposed to do. The judge is supposed to take all of these factors, listen to all the evidence, then apply those factors to the evidence presented to her, and then explain how she's weighing them, acknowledging the seriousness of the offense, but then saying, why waiver, why not waiver? So here's another example of why I'm struggling to find anything in the record to support the idea that this court exercised her discretion. What she was supposed to do is weigh in on the adequacy and suitability of facilities, services, and procedures available for treatment of the juvenile and protection of the public within the juvenile justice system. Here's what she said, and it's not all of what she said, but she talked a lot, but there's not a lot in what she said in those 30 pages. But here's what she said. Here's the problem. I didn't hear any testimony on a timeline that Xavier would need for treatment, and that's a pseudonym. So I can't accept the argument on its face that the amount of time left in the juvenile justice system would be inadequate. So she's rejecting the state's argument, and that's fine. She has the discretion to do that. But what she didn't do is make any findings on why the juvenile justice system would be adequate and suitable for treatment of the juvenile and protection of the public, which, again, we heard nothing about. There's nothing in this transcript except at the end, because she was checking the boxes to make sure she said the magic language. But she never explained, and I've searched the record, counsel. Here's my chart. There's nothing in there.
So what the court indicated is it was, again, I don't want to sound like a broken record, the court indicated it was relying on the testimony from the state's witness who indicated we can handle this in the juvenile justice system, and the detailed testimony of the defense witness who gave the juvenile court a treatment plan of how it could be addressed in the juvenile justice system. And I understand, perhaps based on Your Honor's experience, the social workers always ask to retain. Maybe, I don't know if that's empirically correct or not, but certainly the record evidence that the state elicited in this case was you should retain this juvenile. Court, I am telling you, in my experience assessing juveniles, this juvenile should be retained in the juvenile justice system. And the court relied on that in rendering its ultimate decision.
Attorney August, can you move in your short time left to the second issue on whether the Court of Appeals properly applied Klesser?
So I think the problem with the Court of Appeals' application of Klesser is there's two aspects of Klesser. And we certainly accept the bright line rule in Klesser, which is under the framework of the juvenile justice system, the two-pronged waiver system. The juvenile who stipulates to probable cause at the first stage cannot use the second phase to negate or undermine that probable cause finding that they just stipulated to. I think that's fair, and I think that follows the way the statute's set up. However, as this court indicated in Klesser, and I think relying on sub 3 and sub 5 of the juvenile waiver statute, the juvenile has the right to present arguments and evidence to contest the waiver petition. And that involves contesting the seriousness of the offense and presenting mitigating evidence. And so the juvenile has to be given an opportunity to do that.
And what's the limits on that? Is it the juvenile can do that so long as they're not undermining the elements of the offense?
Right. So I would say as long as the juvenile's not undermining that probable cause finding. And I think that's why Klesser is such a great example, because Klesser, again, it's a reverse waiver case. He's charged with an intentional crime. Says, okay, fine, I'll stipulate that there's probable cause that I intended to kill, and then turns around and submits evidence that he did not intend to kill. And I think that that's a great example of what's not permitted. In this case, the juvenile is charged with a reckless offense, showing utter disregard. And the dispute really is, in one account, his eyes are open when he fires into the crowd. In the other account, his eyes are closed when he fires into the crowd. I don't find that
you know that's worse, I think? Somebody shooting with their eyes closed?
Could you continue?
Thank you, please.
So, responding to the Klesser issue, he's not undermining this account of probable cause. I would point out number two, as I pointed out in my briefs, it's questionable to me whether this is even Zander's evidence, because this was, of course, elicited by the state. I know this court probably doesn't want to get into a discussion of waiver and forfeiture, but I'm sorry. I am out of time. May I finish my answer?
Go ahead and finish, yes.
It is interesting to me that we have the state eliciting evidence and then turns around in the Court of Appeals and says, can you believe the evidence we elicited is in the record? And I think number three would be the substantive reliance issue, which I also talked about in my brief. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I believe that if the juvenile court's decision in this case were anywhere near as comprehensive as defense counsel just tried to make it sound, the state would not have appealed. But a review of the record shows that that is not the case. This case is a textbook example of when a reviewing court should reverse a discretionary decision. And this is because the juvenile court made four serious errors in this case. First, it relied on an untrustworthy hearsay account of the facts to find the facts of the case. And that's the real Klesser issue, which defense counsel has not touched on. Second, it did not make factual findings on most of the waiver criteria, as Justice Bradley has noted. Third, it did not explain how the factual findings it did make supported its decision. And fourth, it flipped the standard for when it's supposed to waive a juvenile into adult court. So this case, I think, is very, very similar to Galleon. And this court in Galleon observed that there's more to making a discretionary decision than just talking about the facts and listing the factors that they're supposed to make. You have to actually take those facts and give a process of reasoning to explain how those facts lead you to your decision. And that's what's lacking in this case. The juvenile court skated over most of the factors, and for the findings it did make, it didn't explain how those findings supported its waiver decision.
Counsel, have we ever applied Galleon to this context?
No, Your Honor, you haven't. But I bring up Galleon simply because it is one of this court's seminal cases on how to evaluate an exercise of discretion.
One of the, you know, challenging things in having sat in the Court of Appeals and reviewed lots of sentencing discretion cases raising a Galleon-type claim that makes it difficult to work with, and this case maybe highlights it, is that we have pretty long-standing law that in every place where a trial court is told to exercise discretion, when a reviewing court looks at that, we're to search the record to see if there's reasons to sustain it. In fact, Galleon even cites, I think, McClearly for that proposition. The problem, of course, is that inherently means that sometimes or that you're dealing with a maybe trial court that doesn't do a great job explaining or connecting, right? You see this all the time in sentencing cases. How many times do you see somebody say, a trial court say, listen, the character, this is a serious offense, and then they move on. The character, he has some things to, there was this testimony, but I think the appropriate thing to do here is X. I'm relying mostly on, deterrence or something like that. And in some ways, this transcript seems to look a lot like that, right? You name some of the different factors. Probably should have, could have done a better job connecting the dots. But this raises, I think, important questions as to the nature of appellate review in these situations and how searching, it's going to be. We don't typically require all the dots to be connected. How do we be faithful to a standard of review and faithful to the instruction to search the record for reasons to sustain the decision and still follow some of the points that you're making here?
Well, thank you, Justice Hagedorn. I think this court has already addressed this issue pretty clearly for a long time. And one of the cases that really gets to the heart of this is Wirtz versus Fleischman, which is 97 West 2nd 100 from 1980. And there this court recognized that when an appellate court is confronted with inadequate findings and the evidence respecting the material facts is in dispute, the only appropriate course for the court is to remand the cause to the trial court for the necessary findings. And I really think that's what we have here, because yes, Ms. Mackey submitted the DFS report that said that she thought that the juvenile should be. But then she got on the stand and testified that this kid had not complied with a single one of his probationary requirements. He hadn't attended school ever. He sent her a text message suggesting that he was still dealing drugs. He was still hanging out with this Eric Garcia person who he was, prohibited from spending any time with. And he had uniformly refused treatment and been hard to get a hold of.
Counsel, is your argument that the transcript that we have in front of us is inadequate and the reasoning was inadequate? Or is your argument that searching the record, there's not evidence from which a reasonable trial court judge could have made this discretionary decision?
So it's a little bit of both of those, Justice Hagedorn, because we've got different levels of what the juvenile court did here with what it was given. So there are some things that I think would probably have to go back for better fact-finding just because we didn't get enough testimony about them, things like the juvenile's motives and attitudes, things like his personality, that never came in through anyone. And when you look at the juvenile court's decision, all the juvenile court had to say about that was, we talked about that, or we went over that. And if you go through the testimony, there's just nothing about that. And so I think for some of those things, we might need more fact-finding. But I think the bigger problem here is the second one that you recognize, and that's that for the facts that the court had in front of it and the findings that it did make, there was just no reasonable basis for it to connect the dots from one to the other. And I think that's very evident in particularly what it said about XS's amenability to treatment. The court looked at his prior record. It noted that he had rejected all prior treatments. His social worker had not been able to get a hold of him, and he hadn't attended a single day of school. He kept telling his social worker that he didn't have any mental health needs and that he was fine, and yet he still wasn't complying with anything. And the court recognized all of that, and then it just said, we deal with CHIPS cases and we can change his behavior. And that doesn't explain anything about how the findings that the court just made related to that decision. It's just not, it's too disconnected. It's talking about general cases and how the court generally handles things, and it doesn't make any specific findings about why that would work for
us. Could a reasonable trial court judge have reached that same conclusion based upon this record? I want you to put aside the explanations that were given.
Yeah.
But in how adequate the connecting the dots, but relying on the trial court's finding that there was not enough time, the juvenile system can sufficiently handle this, et cetera, et cetera. The reasons the trial court did give, even if you think they weren't supported. Put aside the reasons given. Do you think a reasonable trial court judge who had this record before it could have reached the conclusion that this judge reached?
On any particular factor or on the waiver decision as a whole?
The waiver decision as a whole.
No, I do not. I think that given the findings and all the testimony that came in, I suppose it's possible that there, I guess I should walk that back a little. I think given what we have, it would be a very difficult decision to reach to say, yes, this is appropriate for the juvenile system. I would assume that it's possible for a judge to reach that decision, but we would need more explanation about how they got there to be able to ascertain whether that's rational or not. Because we don't know what the juvenile court was relying on here to make this decision. Every single factual finding that they made, as Justice Bradley said, weighed in favor of waiver.
Is that a fair description, though? I mean, I get that people could have reached different decisions. I might have reached a different decision. But really what Justice Hagedorn has outlined is how we're supposed to look at this. And over throughout this record is discussion of she is relying on the experts. She is relying on the two individuals, the only two people that testified. Is that unreasonable?
Well, I mean, I don't think the experts' opinions were unreasonable, and I don't think that what the experts said was unreasonable.
Well, they both gave the opinions that the juvenile justice system could handle this juvenile, could rehabilitate this juvenile, could have treatment, could incarcerate for a period of time, or at least take off the street in a juvenile setting. I mean, regardless of whether you think it's right, or I think it's right, or anyone in here thinks it's right, is it a reasonable decision based on the experts, which was what she said over and over, the state, you've given me nothing else. I've got these two experts, and that's what they're telling me. So is that reasonable?
No, Your Honor, because that's not the only criteria. And that's part of the problem. The court is supposed to consider all of the evidence for all of the criteria that's put in front of it. And when you've got five different criteria, and really we're only disputing four of those here because one wasn't in play, but when you've got five different criteria and the state puts in evidence on all of the criteria and the court is supposed to consider them all and doesn't, that's an erroneous exercise of discretion. We don't have any findings. We don't have any rationale. We've got nothing explaining how the judge reached this decision.
It just sounds to me like you are asking us to change what erroneous exercise of discretion is. Because if I take that standard that you're giving, what we're going to require of circuit court judges, and we do see a lot of transcripts, and some are better than others, for sure. We will no longer be searching the record for reasons to support. We will be searching the record for words that tie this, that tie that. That's the danger, I think, of what your argument is beyond this case.
I don't think that's what the state is asking this court to do, honestly, Justice Dallet. And apart from that, that is not the only error in this case. And I would like to talk then about the hearsay problem, which has just not been touched on by the defense at all in this case.
Before you do that, I'm going to ask you one more question in this line of questioning. And that is, there's been a lot of conversation about what the juvenile court judge relied upon. But at the end of the hearing and in that transcript, she talked about the things she was not able to rely upon, that is, the things that she said the state didn't introduce. And I want you to respond to some of that, if you will.
Sure.
You know what I'm talking about.
I'm
looking on page,
have a bit of an idea.
I'm looking on page 27 of 32 of the transcript, and some of it was, she says she's considering what is still available in the juvenile system. And she says, and if you're trying to read with me, I'm on page 27 of 32, and I'm down line 14.
Okay.
And she says, I'm considering the fact that when we talk about the adequacy of the system, I have no information to opine or find the juvenile system is inadequate to meet Xavier's needs. She goes on and talks about that she doesn't, I'm on the next page now, on about line 6 or 7. I don't have information that would lead me to find that could support a finding that the system is inadequate, particularly given that there are a number of she talks again in the next paragraph, she has no information that would lead her to find the juvenile system as a whole cannot address these risk factors. So I read this as saying the state here didn't provide me with the information it needed. So my point is only that it's the opposite of the questions that proceeded here from Justice Hagedorn and Justice Dallet, and it is that there's a lack in this record.
I don't know how the state, I mean, I don't really know what the court was looking for there, but I think it bears noting that the state put in a vast amount of testimony about the, first of all, the extreme gravity of this offense. It put in testimony explaining why it didn't believe that the juvenile justice system had adequate time and resources left to deal with. And part of that was because only having access in this juvenile system for 1 year doesn't say anything towards the purposes of the juvenile justice system, which include accountability for the juvenile and protection of the public. And as Justice Bradley noted, the juvenile court here didn't make a single finding on how this protected the public. It was just a statement that I find it's in the protection of the public. And I think it's important that, you know, we have case law out there that says that when we've got all of these factors and the state puts in evidence for each of them, the circuit court has to explain how the evidence relates to those factors, and the circuit court just didn't do it here.
When you say the state put in evidence, there's two witnesses, and they both said there's adequate treatment, and they went through all the things that haven't been done yet and all the things that can still be done, and that's what she's referring to here, and they went through all the stuff. And you're right, there may have been all kinds of other things, but the state didn't call an expert to say this isn't enough time. I hear what you're saying, but it doesn't seem to match what is in this transcript.
Can I ask a follow-up question while you think about addressing that question? Because the point that I was trying to make earlier to your friend on the other side is that just because the judge has conclusions from the experts doesn't mean the judge has to accept those conclusions. I kind of look at what the experts were saying here, and then they go on to say, oh, don't waive them. The juvenile justice system is perfectly adequate. I mean, as the Court of Appeals pointed out, what we have, and this is what quoting from the trial court judge, what we have as far as prior treatment history is that he has a history of really of declining and not engaging in several treatment options that have been provided and offered. And so this is the testimony we're getting from the experts, but then they say, oh, keep them in the juvenile system, which, again, is what they always say. But the judge isn't required by law to accept the conclusions of law of expert witnesses. Is the court?
No, and I think that's what the state was trying to articulate. Is it's not necessarily that there's nothing here that could have supported the judge's decision. The problem is the fact finding that she made and the conclusions that she reached, there's no connection between those two. And that's what we need to appropriately exercise a discretionary decision.
It's also an erroneous exercise of discretion when the court misapplies the law, correct?
Correct.
So I'm looking at moving on from the factors for a moment, the decision on waiver. The statute says if the court determines on the record that there is clear and convincing evidence that it is contrary to the best interests of the juvenile or of the public to hear the case, the court shall enter an order waiving jurisdiction. So again, we have the conclusion from the trial court, and I'll read her exact words, I'm not finding that it would be in the public's, that it would be contrary of the public's best interest either. But what I don't see in the record is any findings that the court then analyzed to support that conclusion. And it's the absence of that reasoned basis for her decision that, as I think you phrased it, is a textbook example of a court erroneously exercising discretion. Am I missing something in the record where the court actually did address anywhere public safety other than making that conclusion?
No, Justice Bradley. And, in fact, I have a very similar chart to you that goes through all the factors and tries to find some kind of finding or rationale for them. And really the only finding that the juvenile court made here and explained was it accepted that XS had PTSD, and the state didn't contest that getting shot's probably a traumatic event. And it determined that because it hadn't heard anything about a timeline, that his PTSD could be handled in the juvenile system. But that's it. Those are the only two findings we have. We have nothing about accountability. We have nothing about violence. We have nothing about his attitudes, his pattern of living, his home life. We have nothing about any of the rest of the criteria. And all of the things that we... Yes, Jessica?
I don't want to interrupt you. I do want to ask you a question, but please continue.
Oh, I was just going to say all of the things that we do have seem to cut against waiver, and that's the kind of situation where we rely on the reasoning of the circuit court to determine whether they properly exercise their discretion instead of just making a decision. And this court's been very clear that just making a decision is not an appropriate exercise of discretion, and that's why it requires that explanation.
Counsel, that line that you just ended with is a paraphrase of a line in the Galleon decision. Of course, I like it when both of you stand up and say Galleon is a seminal case.
An excellent decision, Justice Bradley.
It is. No, it is an excellent decision. But the problem with Galleon is that it is never followed. And it is...
I followed it.
I did too.
On review, let me tell you what my assessment of it is. And then you tell me why this case is different. You apparently both champion Galleon because of the formula it sets out, revitalizing, dare I say, reinvigorating McCleary, right? And after Galleon in 2004, we had all sorts of petitions for review. Ha ha! Galleon, they didn't do this. And every single one, and this follows Justice Hagedorn's question, every single one, you know what we said? Well, this is a discretionary determination. Good enough. I do not recall, and there may be a few that I don't recall, but I do not recall ever seeing a case based on Galleon that said it wasn't good enough. In fact, our jurisprudence has evolved to the point it's all good enough as long as it's within the legal range. Now, I only mention this because you both say it should be like Galleon. Well, if it's like the way Galleon is applied, you lose. So tell me how it should be different here, because in Galleon, the way it's been applied is close enough, and it's deferential standard, and we'll search the record, etc. Please.
So I have two answers to that question, Justice Bradley. First of all, I think that the entire state would be better served if we moved back closer to Galleon in our sentencing decisions and everything else for erroneous exercise of discretion. And I feel like the way that the search the record doctrine has been interpreted has really caused some confusion about how courts are supposed to review things for an erroneous exercise of discretion, because we have all these standards about applying, you know, the correct standard of law and reasonably finding the facts and, you know, reasonably explaining the decision. But then we also have this entire doctrine that says, but if they don't do that, we don't care. Sometimes we'll reverse it and sometimes we won't. And I really do think it would probably do a greater service to the state if, you know, there was a more rigorous review for an exercise of discretion, and not just the state, for defendants, because they are also the ones that have to know about why the court reached the decision that it reached. So I think the first part of the answer to that question would be we would be well served to turn back towards Galleon. But I think the second part of the answer to that question is that it's when we view the record as a whole, we just don't have enough to get to a rational decision. We don't. I mean, we have a couple of findings that don't seem to line up with what the juvenile court ended up finding, and we have a complete absence of findings on other things. And I think that that's just not enough to explain a decision. And then I think there's a third prong that we need to talk about here, and that's also going back to the hearsay problem, because...
Well, I know you want to go there, but before you go there, you still have a green light, so you've got plenty of time.
Sure.
Rest assured.
We don't need to rely on Galleon. I think it has helpful language. Yes, it was a sentencing case. This is not. But we can look at the statute, can't we? The decision on waiver mandates that the trial court, after considering the criteria under sub 5, so it appears she did consider the criteria. She certainly laid them out. The court shall state its finding with respect to the criteria on the record. And that's what I don't see having been done. So regardless of, and I think your argument is a two-pronged approach, it's we don't have the findings, so discretion was not reasonably exercised. And a second component of that, which I don't think we even need to go to, is whether the decision is reasonably supported by the facts of the record. We just don't have any findings here.
I would 100% agree, Justice Bradley. And, this court has said before that the court needs to set out, it needs to make findings on all of the criteria, and it needs to explain.
Well, counsel, in the GBK case, however, interpreting that from the Court of Appeals, said that specific findings by the court as to each individual factor are not required, and that this language means that the state is supposed to state its findings on the record with respect to the criteria actually considered, in the sense that what it finds to be relevant, it's supposed to make specific findings on that. It doesn't necessarily need to go through each one and give extensive findings on each of the five. That's my understanding of it. Am I misunderstanding that, or do you disagree with that?
Well, Justice Hagedorn, I don't disagree that that's what that case says. I do disagree that that's all that the case law says, and I believe I cited in my brief. I'm sorry, let me find the page. These cases all have such similar names. I feel like my brain is an alphabet.
Why have you found it? Otherwise,
yes, I have. It's page 16, and it's State versus CW. And, the court made very clear that the juvenile court must consider all five criteria. And, I mean, how are we supposed to know that the court is appropriately considering all five criteria if it just doesn't say anything about them, especially when one of the major criteria is protection of the public, and we've got nothing. We have... This wouldn't be against the public's best interest, and we just don't have any. We have no findings. We have no rationale. We have nothing on that.
Regardless of what our court decisions have said, and you know, the court is. I will admit, the court is wrong sometimes. We have a statute that says if prosecutive merit is found, the court shall base its decision whether to waive jurisdiction on the following criteria, of which there are five. Now, it may be that there. One of the criteria isn't applicable to a particular juvenile, but it doesn't mean it can be ignored.
Agree. And I think we see that in a sentencing context as well. I mean, this is a very straightforward case on this record. The circuit court didn't make the findings, and the findings that it did make didn't support its decision.
Now your yellow light is on.
Now my yellow light is on. Okay.
Right. And I would like to hear about how hearsay is problematic in this case. Okay?
Absolutely, Justice Rogenczak. And I think even if this court were to say, okay, well, we can reasonably look at the record and, you know, yes, the court, there's plenty in the record that could support it. This still needs to be overturned because the juvenile court erroneously applied the law. And that is a black letter standard exercise of discretion. And I think Klesser, too, answered this quite definitively. And the problem here is that the juvenile court relied on the hearsay testimony of Dr. Thompson about the facts of the offense. And it found that XS just closed his eyes and shot into this group of people.
The court found that?
Yes. The court says that in its decision.
Okay. Not like that it doesn't, but I guess, I mean, I'd rather you spend your time arguing. I know where that is, but if you...
I can find it for you, Justice Dallet, but the court says he essentially closed his eyes.
No, the court says Dr.
People.
Thompson said that, and when reviewing the credibility of Dr. Thompson, that's what Dr. Thompson said. But so I guess there's a question of whether the court relied on it. But are you saying that the problem is that it came through as hearsay, or are you saying that juveniles are not allowed to put in evidence as long as they don't dispute the elements of the crime, can a juvenile still put in other evidence? Because you know that when they, similar to a preliminary hearing, you might waive it, but it doesn't mean every single thing in the complaint is true. And is a juvenile stuck with every single thing that's in the petition, or can they put forward other evidence?
No, that's not the putting forward other evidence. They can absolutely put forward other evidence. The problem here is when the juvenile court made its determination that this wasn't premeditated, it credited as fact the account that XS gave to Thompson that he felt threatened and he fired and shot into this group of people. And the problem there is the only factual support for that statement is XS's self-serving statement to Dr. Thompson. And while hearsay is admissible, it's not unqualifiedly admissible. It has to be attended by substantial guarantees of trustworthiness.
Does it matter that it was the state's questioning that elicited that response?
I don't think that the state had a way could be expected to anticipate that that's what the response was going to be. Here is the thing that I think that separates, though, the fact that this came out from the state's questioning from the problem here, and that's how it was used. Had this hearsay testimony just come in and the circuit court would not have credited it as fact, I don't think we'd have a problem. But the fact that the juvenile court credited it as the facts of the offense, Klesser says that you cannot do that unless this hearsay statement is attended by substantial guarantees of trustworthiness, and we don't have any of those. None of them.
Does it matter that this came in? Because, I mean, for one, the XS went to the mall with a gun, first of all, showing some premeditation for something. And as Justice Rebecca Bradley said, it might be worse if you shot a gun with your eyes closed as far as the recklessness, which is what the ultimate charge was. So does it matter?
I don't think it matters to the ultimate charge, Justice Kurofsky. I think it matters because the circuit court relied on it as fact to make a finding that this wasn't premeditated. And that's important because that's one of the findings that the court has to consider when it's making a waiver decision. And had this been attended by some kind of guarantees of trustworthiness, I mean, had Thompson gotten that account from, let's say, one of the witnesses told the police, I saw him close his eyes and, you know, shoot into this group of people. Or even better, if one of the victims would have said that to police. And Thompson pulled this out of a police report, then we've met the first Sorensen factor, because that's the situation where it's not likely that somebody would fabricate the event. And I see my red light is on, so unless there's anything else.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, I would like you to address whether or not shall means shall.
How's that for a word question?
Because in other contexts, family law, and I think particularly of 767, you know, which deals with family law and custody. And we say the court shall consider the following factors in making its determination. And yet I think it's with regard to the custody, but it may be visitation, where we have a case that it says, well, you know, only the ones shall doesn't really mean shall here. You don't have to go through all of the factors, but you have to address courts, the ones that are most relevant to you. So you don't have to cover everything if it doesn't really apply, right? So how does that fit in with this statute? Maybe it's different, maybe it's the same.
So I would say, number one, as Justice Hagedorn has already pointed out, I think that the statute has already been interpreted for the proposition that the circuit court is not required to make the kind of small-scale findings that the state is pushing for in this
case. Is that GBK?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And so I think also this gets back to this question of deference. And I think that's a point I want to make, is that we have a deferential standard of review for a reason, and we acknowledge that the deferential standard of review is important because, again, as I stated previously, these circumstances, whether it's a decision to waive a juvenile, whether it's a decision to send someone to prison, whether it's something like who's going to get the house in a complicated divorce, these are circumstances in which we acknowledge kind of candidly in the cases. There's a sort of epistemological acknowledgement here that there's oftentimes not a mathematically derivable answer.
Counsel, you didn't have a chance to talk about the hearsay problem that counsel kept wanting to bring up. I'd like you to address it now because I am concerned that the trial court took the testimony from the doctor's expert opinion and made it into the facts of the event. So would you address that, please?
Certainly. So I went through this at length in my reply brief, and I'm troubled by this repeated claim by the state that the trial court made a finding of fact that this account is what happened. I think the record belies that claim, and I don't think that that is accurate at all. The trial court explicitly told counsel for the state that it was crediting the allegations given by the state. The only support is this comment made in the broader context where the court is talking at length about the offense, and it's addressing specifically Attorney Paul Rafael, who was representing the juvenile, and it was talking about the memorandum that Attorney Rafael filed. And it was talking about, in that memorandum, the number of mitigating considerations, all of which are taken from the delinquency petition. It interrupted itself at some point to say, oh, I should address Dr. Thompson for a moment, said, you know, there's been dispute about that. I'm going to find that I don't think he's kind of intentionally offered any untruthful testimony and kind of left it at that, shifted back to, again, returning to addressing counsel and said, you brought up some relevant considerations about the mitigation, et cetera. The state would have this court believe that what the court was saying is you, Dr. Thompson, brought up relevant considerations. I think obviously this court, I have the utmost confidence in this court's ability to read the record. And the record doesn't support that claim.
Where else in the record, besides Dr. Thompson's testimony, is there evidence that he shut his eyes and shot at the people?
So, again, that comes from the statement elicited by the state in Dr. Thompson's testimony.
It doesn't matter who elicited it. I'm just asking you, is there other testimony in the record that says that, besides his?
No, it's only Dr. Thompson's testimony, but again, the court never made an affirmative finding. That is what I am finding happened. Instead, the court, again, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, the court told Attorney Waldschmidt, representing the state, there's no better way for me to describe this than what the state has essentially already said. I do not know how you get from that to an affirmative finding of I'm supporting this finding from Dr. Thompson.
Well, the court did say, in considering the description of the way that the events unfolded, and she's referring back, this is pages 21 to 22 of the transcript, I think you shed some light on our discussion about whether that act was premeditated. So that does suggest that the trial court was crediting the version of the events given by excess to Dr. Thompson, doesn't it?
May I respond, Your Honor? This is the exact sentence that I was just referring to, and I would just direct Your Honor to my reply brief. You shed some light. I do not think that the court is referring to Dr. Thompson. I think if you read that comment in context, it is clear. The you that is being addressed is counsel for excess. That is, I think, the only reasonable interpretation of that utterance. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for interesting briefs and oral argument. The court will recess now and reconvene at 1:30 in closed.